In this episode, I am going to share with you an interview I did with the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast folks. Wes Carter and I talked, and what we had to say is extremely applicable to not just PSM, but also to general industry, and I wanted to share it with you on my podcast. So consider this a takeover episode, and I want you to go check out the Amplify team and follow the links in the show notes. I hope you enjoy this episode where I talked with Wes on the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. Let's get into it.
Welcome to the Safety Pro Podcast, powered by iReport Source, helping you manage safety one episode at a time. With the constant regulatory and workplace culture challenges businesses face, we'll provide you with all the relevant information necessary to achieve a safer, more productive workplace. No management theories, platitudes, or guru speak, just actionable info you can use right away. Now here's your host, the Safety Pro himself, Blaine Hoffman.
Welcome to the Amplify Your Process Safety Podcast. My name is Wesley Carter, and today I have a special guest, Mr. Blaine Hoffman. Blaine, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for the listening audience?
Thanks, Wesley. As Wes mentioned, I'm Blaine Hoffman. I am the producer and host of the Safety Pro Podcast. And, you know, we met through the podcast, so it's kind of fitting we wanted to do some sort of a joint venture on some topics, and you know, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, sir. I really hope you know, I was really looking forward to this, and unfortunately, with travel restrictions, I would prefer to do this in person. But we adjust, right? We make it happen,
right?
So today's topic, like you said, we're going to do some joint episodes. You know, Blaine, I don't like to put us in boxes, but you know, for our listening audience, we've done an episode together back in that was at the VPP. PA conference, right? In New Orleans. Yes, sir. And
back when we were allowed to travel and do things face to face, but you know,
yes, life was normal. We adjust.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so in that episode, we talked about the differences and the overlap, the differences and the kind of similarities between process safety and occupational safety. And so that's kind of the flavor of these episodes we're doing together. And today's topic, we wanted to talk about incident investigation. You know, so for the listening audience, what you can expect is kind of some key takeaways from this episode, from both not only a process safety and occupational safety slant, but what does the regulation say about incident investigations? What is it, you know, specifically in general industry and PSM/RMP, and why is it important? You know, so some key takeaways from this episode. So, Blaine, I'm going to go ahead and get into what the regulation says for PSM, RMP, and then we'll kind of talk through that. And then I think we'll run into, you know, some stuff that's found in general industry, because it's not as explicit as it's written in the PSM, RMP regulation.
Perfect.
Yeah, so what does the regulation say? So OSHA 1910-119, paragraph M in the OSHA PSM standard says the employer shall investigate each incident which resulted in, and this is important, or could reasonably have resulted in a catastrophic release of highly hazardous chemicals in the workplace. So they basically are just saying you have to do an investigation if you have a release of these highly flammable, highly toxic chemicals, because obviously the hazard potential is pretty high for these. And then they got a few requirements in there that say the investigation has to be initiated as soon as possible, but you can't go more than 48 hours following the incident. The team has to be pretty diverse, and so at a minimum, consist of at least one person knowledgeable in the process, include a contract employee if the incident involved the work of a contractor, and other persons with appropriate knowledge and experience to thoroughly investigate the incident. And then they give some kind of guidance on what the report's minimum requirements are. So the date of the incident, the date the investigation began, a description of the incident, factors that contributed to the incident, and any recommendations resulting from the investigation. And then there's another part, which is kind of a staple in the regulation, which was the employer shall establish a system to promptly address and resolve the report findings and recommendations. You have to document that. And the report shall be reviewed with all affected personnel whose job tasks are relevant to the incident findings. And then incident investigation report shall be retained for 5 years. Now, Blaine, you know, R&P just, you know, kind of points over to the PSM similar type stuff, but when I read through that, and you know, and we'll go, I'd like you to kind of transition into what's, you know, how some of the stuff that's in general industry, but does any of that sound like a bad idea, or does that seem, I mean, what's your take on what I just read through?
Well, it seems pretty straightforward to me, and it's what, you know, safety professionals would expect in the workplace, certainly.
Yeah, it's, you know, when I read through this part of the regulation, it makes complete sense to me. You had a release, or under slightly different circumstances, you could have this catastrophic release. And then they're saying, you know, investigate it, make sure you have a good team. If you involved a contractor, make sure they're involved in the investigation. If you had any findings, make sure you track them to closure, retain the report, share the findings. It's pretty good stuff. You know, so what do we find, you know, in your experience when we get into general industry, general occupational health and safety?
Well, we don't find that level of detail. We have, under the 1904 standard, 29 CFR Part 1904, the general record keeping and reporting requirements. They basically spell out the forms that you have to fill out. Those forms will direct you, in the context of certain questions, to go seek an understanding as to how something happened. So if you were to look at the OSHA 301 form, you are allowed to use your own accident report as long as that accident report has, at a minimum, the exact same information the 301 requires. But the 301 form is really where you're going to find this investigation. I'm using air quotes here, where we have some key questions such as, what was the employee doing just prior to the event? You know, what caused the accident? It's very vague. It actually is not an approach that we would recommend in general industry at all. You know, when we talk about root cause, sort of like what you laid out, where we have, you know, defined parties, that interested parties that need to be involved, things like that. So in general industry, it's really incumbent upon each employer to deploy an approach that is suitable for their work environment. And the aim, ultimately, the goal is to prevent future incidents, to get to these root causes so that you can fix, you know, what led up to that event. So it's kind of vague. It's not real great. It's not a great approach, but it's one that we've been managing over the years, as you know.
You know, so you kind of, you know, kind of towards the back end there, you started getting into some, you know, why incident investigation is important. And you were talking about kind of like some of the approach that's in there, you know, when filling that out isn't something that's recommended. You know, so what's your, you know, why, and your, you know, why is incident investigation ultimately important, any type of an incident? And I'm not, you know, I'll get into a fact sheet here a little bit in the podcast about, you know, investigating someone who slipped on a, you know, a puddle of oil, and all the way to investigating, you know, a vapor cloud release of a toxic chemical in a facility. Why is incident investigation, you know, in Blaine Hoffman's point of view, why is incident investigation important?
Well, the main reason is to determine what led up to the event so that you can prevent a similar event in the future. I mean, that's just very high level, elementary answer that I would give you. There are a lot of things that go into that, though, and this is where people get hung up. Obviously, we want to prevent injuries and incidents, even minor ones. And in order to do that, we have to dig deep and really understand all of the potential contributing factors that led up to that event or incident. And the only way to do it, go ahead.
Yeah, you said something there. Even the minor ones.
Yeah.
Even the minor ones. Why is it important to investigate minor incidents as well?
So a great example is, you know, and I could get into Heinrich's triangle and, you know, then start that whole debate as to whether that's even valid or has or has not been validated.
That's the Heinrich's triangle. That's the one that says, like, for every 10,000 near misses, there's a first aid.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, kind of works its way up, right? Until ultimately you reach the top of the pyramid, right? Or top of the triangle.
Yeah. You know, for if we're trying to stop the serious incident or fatality, to which there are a number of first aids, to which there are hundreds of near misses, then we have to investigate, you know, starting at the base, right? But, you know, not citing that specific study, but this theory, this approach of, okay, if I have a minor incident, let's say somebody almost slips on oil on the floor. They don't slip and fall, though, but they lose their footing, catch themselves, and they keep walking. And we're like, wow, we dodged a bullet there. And we all just shrug and walk on. Yeah, it's just a matter of time, right? Before we're going to go back and look at that scenario again, except this time it was a fall. Maybe it was a broken arm or wrist. Maybe it was a concussion, or God forbid, worse. But you're going to be looking at that same scenario. So intervening at the minor level, every time one occurs, you're going to learn about similar contributing factors. Do we do maintenance in this area that's not cleaned up? Do we have equipment that's leaking? Was it a contractor that came through this area and dripped some stuff? Where is it a pipe that's leaking? Is there a valve that's faulty? What's the PM on that? Where did we buy that one? Do we have similar ones in the? And you, so you know, and this is speaking to your, you know, this is getting into your category, but you see where this goes. Why wait for a catastrophic release or a fatality or a lost time injury to actually start digging into these things? So the approach you take to all of them should be uniform. It should be, if anything, for a matter of exercise, that you go through this. What's frustrating for us in the general industry is that we do take a different approach sometimes when it's a minor incident versus lost time. Employers get all worked up when we say, oh, we had a lost time injury. We have to, you know, we have to do certain things and jump through certain hoops. And we probably just got done talking about two first aids that were minor, dealing with, you know, machinery, equipment, or guarding that's loose or something like that. And we didn't get all worked up about it. So that's the issue we run into in general industry as a result of not having some clear written guidance like you find in PSM.
Oh, you you know, the guidance is clear. But I can tell you, you know, there's a, you know, because the regulation right at the beginning, right, when I was reading, said you have to investigate an incident that resulted in a catastrophic release of a highly hazardous chemical, you know, flammable, something registered in the appendix of the regulation, one of those chemicals, or under different circumstances, right, had the potential to. So that in itself leads enough gray area where we run into the same thing when you're talking about, you know, these process, you know, PSM, RMP regulated facilities, is what is categorized as a PSM, you know, I'm doing, use the word air quotes, incident, PSM incident. You know, it's amazing for me, like I do investigations and I do a lot of, I'll call them PSM incident investigations. So we had a release of highly hazardous chemicals and maybe we burned down some equipment, or we had a pretty substantial fire, or we had a pretty good vapor cloud release, you know, without ignition, something like that. And it's happened more than once where I've sat in the investigation and when we're building a timeline and I'm doing some interviews with personnel and, you know, I'm just kind of just, you know, what happened, you know, has this happened before? Like, and multiple times, and I'll go back to my early days as a facilities engineer upstream, and I supported a certain field and they had a positive displacement pump that caught on fire. And I was talking to the operator out there about, you know, because he came up on scene, he shut it in, it was small enough to put out with a fire extinguisher, you know, and then he reported it. And after speaking with him, that was the fourth time that a piece of equipment, a small overpressure protection, that PSV, had cracked in its connection to the piping on the discharge side and had started spraying hydrocarbons. That was the fourth time. The first three times, it was just spraying the hydrocarbons to flammable without ignition. And it was the fourth time that it actually caught on fire that they went and reported it, and we did a big investigation. And so it's you know, that's a very, that was a very minor, you know, small piece of equipment, you know, but you never know. Someone could have been in the area at that time, and, you know, and that the damage to that pump, you know, cost-wise, maybe you're talking $50,000, if that. But that happens often when we get into this, you know, area where people are talking about, well, under different circumstances, it could have been this or that. And then you get into the difficulty, you know, if I'm walking around a facility and I've got these overpressure protection devices, and sometimes they go to a closed system like a flare. And, you know, for the audience, right, you have this PSV, this pressure safety valve, that's sitting on a vessel. And if it comes to an overpressure scenario, it'll relieve. That way the vessel, you know, can stay within its, you know, mechanical limits, its maximum allowable working pressure. And so you're walking through a facility, and some of these PSVs flare, sometimes they go to atmosphere, depending on what's inside. And if an operator walks by and a PSV just kind of chatters and sprays this just for a second and then closes, it's hard to get an operator to report that, because, you know, like you said, you don't treat, you know, sometimes you see not the same amount of effort go into like the major events versus the very minor ones, right? There was some oil on the floor, and then, you know, but we saw it and we reported it, but no one was hurt. There's no direct consequence. It's not treated the same as if someone had, you know, slipped and broke their leg and it was a day away from work case, right?
Right. Hey, misery loves company is what I'm hearing. Yeah. So the language in the PSM standard at least gets us a little closer in that they identify interested parties and some things like that. We've got to go on the general industry side, everywhere else, I should say. We've got to go to like some Q&A or FAQs to get some guidance. And even then, it's not even enforceable. But on the OSHA 301 record keeping form, the incident investigation, if you will, I'm using that term loosely, there are four questions. It's five. The fifth one mostly doesn't apply, but there are four questions. What was the employee doing just before the incident occurred? What happened? What was the injury or illness? What object or substance directly harmed the employee? And then the last one is, if the employee died, when did death occur? So that's it.
Oh,
that's all we have.
That's a, now, 20% of the questions, if there was a death.
Right, I know. So we can go to, there is an FAQ, and I'll shoot you the link to this. It's the OSHA Instruction for Record Keeping Policies and Procedures Manual. But essentially, way down like into the Q&A section, the question is, may employers attach missing information to their accident investigation or workers' compensation forms to make them acceptable substitute form for the 301 record-keeping purposes? So yeah, you can use a workers' comp form or other form that does not contain all of the required information that the 301 has, provided the form is supplemented to contain the missing information. So they're saying, yeah, you could use a fishbone. You can use a FEMA, like if you've done some sort of like a bow tie analysis of the event, right? And you've identified, you know, things prior to the event and then out, you know, different outcomes, and you can supply all that as long as you fill in the other things that the 301 form asks for. And there's other things on that form like date of hire, date of birth, address, things like that. But yeah, I mean, it's very vague. It's really, and this is why, as you know, a consultant, and you've just illustrated this, why we see wide variations in how different organizations approach different types of incidents. There's no consistent way of approaching this that I've found.
Yeah, you know, and I think also you probably have similar experience to this. When you get into an incident investigation, unless you work for a large organization that's established, like this is our methodology, everyone has the best in methodology out there. And what I mean by, you know, I do the 5-Y, I do fishbone, you know, I only do bow tie, You know, I only do Apollo, you know, I only do, you know, what's the Taproot, you know?
Taproot, yeah.
And it's the best, you know, the other ones are all crap. That's what you'll hear.
You Hop, know, Hop you know, is the other one. Human and organizational performance is a big one now, which I like aspects, and if you've heard any of my past episodes on some of these, the ones that you've named, but you've got to fit the tool to the circumstance, to the event. Some events, you know, like you mentioned, some valves or some mechanical degradation, you know, traditional root cause analysis lends itself very well to things that break.
Yep.
Processes that fail when people are interacting with them, it's a little different. You may need a combination of traditional root cause analysis, you know, 5Y or fishbone, and more of a human and organizational performance approach, you know, to the human aspect of it. But you've got to be well versed in many of these approaches. I don't think there is a silver bullet. Have you found yet that one thing that works?
No. No, and that's why, you know, because you understand, like, I think you said it well. I mean, you got to have a number of tools in your kit, right? Depending on what you're trying to investigate and what's the right tool. And oftentimes I hear, you know, when, you know, someone will ask, like, you know, what types of incident investigation methodologies have you been trained in? You know, if you leave off their favorite, they're like, well, you obviously don't understand what the best methodology is, you know, or something like that. And I think it really is. They all work, you know. Just, are you trained in it? Do you have sufficient experience? And is it the right approach for the type of incident you're investigating? You know, I think that's kind of my, you know, my thoughts on it, you know, but all of them, you're eventually trying to get to that. I'll call it, you know, some buzzwords here, but you're getting to the root cause. You know what, you know, Blaine, what is a root cause? You know, we have an incident. What is a root cause?
Root cause to me is, and I know somebody, there's some word nerd out there that's going to chime in on this, and that's okay. But but to me, in my mind, a root cause is just one potential contributing factor that set off a chain of events, either directly or indirectly, that led to the outcome we're looking at, right? And I always say causes. I always say there's probably multiple root causes. And again, I'd ask you, in your experience, especially on the PSM side, have you come across this single, you know, point of failure? Even single point of failure is sort of a misnomer. You know, how did we get a single point of failure? There was probably multiple things that had to happen to allow that single point of failure to exist, right? So to me, a root cause is just but one contributing factors that were at play, right? That we could touch and we could influence, thus changing the outcome. If you watch Back to the Future, we were watching those over the weekend.
I just burned through those this last week.
Nice. Yeah. They're on Netflix. But it's a great example of, if you touch one thing, like, multiple things change. If you touch multiple things, like, all sorts of stuff changes. So it's sort of that same theory. Is, to me, a root cause is just one thing we could have influenced to potentially change an outcome.
Yeah, there's, you know, I like what you said. I, you know, my experience, you know, doing these, you know, it's rare that I can point, you know, I'm not saying it's never, but it's rare that I can point to a single. Oftentimes it's, you know, a couple, you know, at a minimum, you know, and then the dive in. But, you know, I think regardless of how we define it, you know, there's an understanding of what a root cause is and why is it so important when you do an investigation. Because I remember when I was first getting trained and I took a week-long course, you know, I worked for a super major in oil and gas, and I took a week-long course in root cause analysis, and they just beat it into us about how they would show us reports where they had done this, had this incident. They went through the whole thing. They had all these causes and stuff, but none of them were really a root cause type. You know, and if they didn't, you know, they basically allowed or they left the environment or the workplace in such a condition where the event could be repeated, even though they had all these recommendations. So why is it important to get to the root cause of an incident?
So I will use an example, and I know we planned on talking about this, but because you kind of led into this, which was perfect. So let's say human error, right, is a root cause. That's what we determined led to this event. You still have to go deeper. The whole point of the root cause is to almost go to a point where you could not have controlled anything anymore, right? That you're getting to a point that's almost ridiculous. It should feel ridiculous. If it doesn't feel that you've gone to the nth degree with this, then you're probably doing it wrong, right? So human error. And I learned this working in aviation, even with the DOD. They were pretty good at going deep. So human error. If there was an incident and you deemed it human error, you would have to define what created or caused or led to the error. So let's say fatigue. A worker wasn't paying attention. Worker was tired. Okay. What was the last shift work? How many hours did they work the last shift? When was the last break? Even getting into, is there something going on at home? Do they have a second job? What led to the fatigue? So you have to keep going deeper. You can't just say human error. Worker needed to be coached. And you mentioned training, the training you went through. There you go. Let's say you went through that training and you just described it. It still left you wanting, right? It didn't really go deep enough. And let's say folks come out of that training, they're performing to the training standard, and they miss potential contributing factors to incidents, thus leading to recurrences, like a trend. And let's say higher-ups in the organization or a regulator are saying, hey, you've had multiple, you know, incidents of this type. What's going on in your, well, we followed the training. We did the investigation, you know, according to our training. Okay, so lack of training, improper training could have been a contributing factor to the trend that you're seeing. And then, so what does that tell you? That doesn't really say much, right? Well, how was the training designed? When was it last updated? Who oversees training? Do you audit training competency? And do you have a rhythm around retraining? What about when industry standards change or I hate to use the word best practices, but, you know, best in class approaches or tools that are developed. Do you have anything to keep up on the training? So you have to go to that ridiculous level, if that makes sense, to really get to a true root cause. I often see folks just scratch the surface and say, oh, I coached the employee because, you know, they indicated they didn't really know they had to do it that way. Really, what's your onboarding process look like? Did you go and talk to any training personnel? Did you look at the written, is there a written procedure for what they were doing? Is it posted? Is it well known? You know, there are so many other questions you need to get to. And we're just talking about this off the cuff on a podcast, yeah. But you can imagine how this should be structured, right? This should be a managed process in and of itself, and has to be audited as well. So,
yeah, I think the way you're going about this, you know, why it's important, you know, because there's systemic things, you know, organizations have certain things that are systemic, and if you put human error. And like you said, they, you know, the result is, the employee said they didn't understand. Well, the next human that they hire, if their onboarding process, if that's intent, that's where they should do it. Is there ever a box they ever have to check to inform a new employee of that requirement, right? You know, and so you really start to get some systemic things, some management things, some policies that are lacking, you know, when you start pointing to things like this.
Yeah.
You know, when I do human error, I often try to put myself in this. I don't know why I do this. It seems very simple, but I call it operators, but operator error. But I'll go, I think of operator A, operator B. If I'm ever going to put operator error down somewhere, I think operator A, operator B. That way I can really, really put myself in their shoes to say, okay, this operator A did this in this scenario. If I bring a new operator B into this scenario, what is the system set up in such a way that new operator could have the same failure?
Yeah, and that's a great approach, because one of the other pitfalls, not to go down a rabbit hole of like do's and don'ts of incident investigation, but one of the pitfalls is confirmation bias. And one of the most frequently cited biases that I see is the individual, like shoot the messenger.
Yeah.
Right. So let's say Blaine reports that he pulled the muscle in his shoulder lifting an object, and everybody rolls their eyes and goes, oh, well, you got to know Blaine. And I would say, no, I don't actually. I don't have to know Blaine. I just have to vet out, is what Blaine's saying valid? That's it. So objectivity is key. Having a team approach, having multiple people trained to do this. It doesn't matter if Blaine's, you know, got that personality where he's always griping about something. And I've told my teams in the past, and even now today, you know, we have to be right 100% of the time. You know, it's that one time we just shrug it off and go, oh, well, you just don't know Blaine, and something bad is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But these tools, these approaches, the various tools in our kit, these are all things that we can pull out to confirm, to validate or invalidate something objectively. And that's key too. And one of the best things, you said operator A and operator B, the easiest thing to do, it's one of my favorite things to do, is say, okay, well, Blaine says that this is the way he's lifting or moving these objects or operating this machine. You know, you obviously go through the manuals, you go through the SOPs, you go through the trainings, but you also go to another operator. Go do another observation of somebody else doing the same job, maybe on a different shift, maybe under a different supervisor, maybe one that was a little more, you know, newer, maybe one that's been around for a while. Try to find, you know, some other examples of this task being performed and check against that. And if there is a differential, why? Now you've got to chase that.
Yeah.
Down. So there are so many cool little things you can do to really do this justice. I think the injustice is we just say, oh, well, you know, that's Blaine. He's probably just, you know, he just doesn't know what he's doing. So I coached them.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we change nothing about the environment and the way I have to do what I do. You've just made it more difficult for me to do it by putting more restrictions on me, but not changing the physical, you know, task itself or materials that I'm dealing with.
You're kind of rolling the dice. Right?
Yeah.
Right? You got the same environment. It could happen again, unless I've got that, you know, I got that operator, that, you know, that employee that, you know, is this better than the rest, you know, the, you know, kind of the, the diamond in the rough. But no, that's good. You know, so I think I wanted to point to some resources for our listening audience. You know, I think we'd be beneficial for both. You know, so one thing that I think we'll include, but, you know, when I was looking through, is OSHA and the EPA put out these kind of a series of informational fact sheets. And there's one they put out in 2016. This fact sheet, you know, it's a joint venture between OSHA and EPA. And it's the importance of root cause analysis during incident investigation. And it's a pretty good read. You know, they go through kind of the PSM, R&P requirements, how to conduct an RCA. The benefits of root cause analysis for employers, root cause tools. And then what I really like about this is they have a resources section. And this is only a 2-page or 3-page document. 1/3 of this is just resources. And it's really good. I mean, they go into, you know, some Center for Chemical Process Safety books, like the Guidelines for Investigating Chemical Process Incidents, Guidelines for Root Cause Analysis by the Department of Energy, a handbook for accident operational safety analysis, Just lots of good references that if, you know, if someone is looking for a good one to pick up and read, I think is really, really nice. And we'll include that as part of the release, you know, a link to that fact sheet. And then Blaine, this is something you've spoke to on your podcast, at least more than once, but I think you wanted to point to one specifically, right?
Yeah, episode 82. I did a series on safety management systems, and this episode 82 was part three, what is root cause analysis? You know, the whole series gets into what is systems thinking and what is PDCA, what is RCA or root cause analysis. So, you know, I would point to this one in particular for what we've been talking about because it kind of ties together some of the things that we talked about, but also some things listed in that fact sheet. So yeah, there's a lot of great resources out there and training, and getting back to what you mentioned earlier, don't just latch onto one because it's comfortable or familiar to you. Diversify a little bit. You never know when you're going to need a different approach.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I really appreciate your time, Blaine, on incident investigation, because I think we've both had quite a bit of experience in this kind of area, but I think kind of from different approaches, you know, or different types, you know, me supporting process safety, you know, you being an expert in occupational health and safety. You know, so I really appreciate your take, because I think that we, again, just like we have similarities, we also have a little bit of differences, you know, just, and that's a flavor of the industry and, you know, disciplines we support. But I think that, you know, for our audience, kind of as a closing, organizations benefit from investigating incidents of any type, you know, process safety, you know, a slip, trip, and fall, you know, organizations benefit from this because without this proper analysis, investigating to a root cause, you kind of allow, you know, incidences can reoccur. And that's kind of what we're trying to prevent, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I read it in a lean safety book years ago, but it talked about focus on the process, not the person. It is about process improvement. And I will tell you, Assistant Secretary of Labor years ago, Lord help me, I'm going to quote the Assistant Secretary of Labor. But on this topic, the quote was accurate records are not simply paperwork, but have an important and, in fact, life-saving purpose. They will enable employers, employees, researchers, and the government to identify and eliminate the most serious workplace hazards. So, you know, this get hung up on the standards sometimes, right? We all do. It drives, at least a minimum, our starting point where we start our work. But also what's missing sometimes is the spirit, the intent of that standard, and how it can transfer to other situations and scenarios when it makes sense. So that right there, that quote speaks to the spirit and intent, at least in the general industry, about the record keeping requirements, why we're required to fill out that 301. And that's important.
Absolutely. Well, Blaine, I appreciate your time today on the podcast. And I guess since this is a joint one, I enjoyed being on your podcast as well.
Absolutely, Wes. It's always a pleasure. I love working together.
Yes, sir. Until next time, take care of yourself. And thank you, audience, for listening.
All right. There you go, Wes. A fine fellow indeed. I enjoy talking with him. And I love all their things they're doing over there at the Amplify Your Process Safety podcast. Continue to check them out. I encourage you to broaden your horizons as a safety professional. Get to know the PSM standards. You could learn a lot. A lot of these things transfer over to the general industry, some best practices and approaches to things. So let me know what you think. What did you get out of this episode? And I look forward to talking to Wes on future episodes as well. And I look forward to talking to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast episode.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Safety Pro Podcast, powered by iReport Source, the all-in-one digital safety solution. For info on how you can request a free demo on all the capabilities of iReport Source to streamline your business's safety management system, head over to thesafetypropodcast.com. We look forward to helping you manage safety on the next episode of the Safety Pro Podcast.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.